Okay, two, my speaker's working, so thank you. It was a bad microphone cord, so I fixed that. We have two things we want to do before we start. Vicki wants to talk for a minute, or you want me to do it?
No, it's fine.
Okay.
I'm going to pass this brochure around that I got this week from Sight and Sound. This is the main thing for our trip, and it's in October. We want to invite everyone. You don't have to go. You have friends that want to go. We get the whole bus if we have 35 people going. They don't have to open it up to anybody else. It's a brand new bus. Stan, who is the leader, he's a retired minister of music from our past church. He will be here maybe next Sunday to talk about it a little bit, but I'm going to pass this brochure around and you can kind of get, this is Sight and Sound Theater right here on the front.
In Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
In Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And here's the brochure. I'm going to pass this around for those who did not get one. And you can look at that while Jim's teaching.
You can also tell me if you're coming and you don't have to text me or email.
Yeah. Okay. The thing I want to say is we're probably in another couple of weeks going to do another discussion about mission work. Randy has a project he's working on. I'm going to send a note out probably this week with a video to look at. So we've got Honduras, we've got Tunisia, and we're going to have
Ghana
in Africa. So they're all different, by the way. So just listen, and hopefully it'll be a good time to get your own ideas and get them on in your own mind. And we're thankful to have Sue back and Jeff back and get that kind of stuff. So I want to welcome Janine. I want to welcome Carol and Linda today. And this is kind of a normal class, a little bigger than it has been because we've got people that are back in from sickness. But we're happy you're here. They're former teachers. They just finished teaching a Sojourners class. And so they're on a sabbatical. So they're going to, I guess, test some classes out. We're glad you're here. We are in the middle of John. We're in chapter 19, and we're gonna read chapter 19. I'm gonna put some other things into it as we go, because I want to make some points that are important to understand as you go through John's gospel. As I've mentioned before, John's gospel was the last one written, and it was written not to replace any of the others, but primarily to add things they didn't cover and also put some perspective that time gives. And John was almost, well, I don't know how old John was, but this was about AD 95, so it's about 62 years after the death of Christ that he writes the Revelation, and the book of John is written maybe 10 years sooner. So a lot of time has passed. He's the only apostle left. He's the last one that can add anything to the story. And so that's what he does, and we're going to read that today. This account is packed today because, as you remember before, John makes a pretty short work of a lot of the early part of the gospel. But when he gets to the part that starts in the upper room, it slows down to a real small pace. When he gets to the part we're in now, we spent 2 weeks on the upper room, or 3 weeks on the upper room. Now we're going to spend a whole session on the crucifixion today. And that's not even enough time because, if you look at Matthew, if you look at Mark, if you look at Luke, you see other narratives which are important. I'm going to cover some of them today, but I'm not going to do all of that. You can go read that. But last week we finished with a session of John in recording the trial of Jesus. And just, I want to recap a couple of things before we move on to this part of the story. It was clear, you wouldn't know it by reading the gospel, but if you read back in the Hebrew law, back in the Old Testament, or if you know anything about Hebrew law, or you study that, you'll discover that virtually everything they did here was illegal for the time. And I'll run through a few of them for you. First of all, trials had to be in the daytime, not at night. And so, when they arrested Jesus, they brought him in, and both Annas and Caiaphas spent time with him in the wee hours of the morning. In what you had to say was the beginnings of a kangaroo court. They had witnesses, you read in the other Gospels, but none of their stories were together. None of them would hold together. And so by Jewish law, they couldn't indict somebody if they didn't have a witness or multiple witnesses with coherent stories. So what they did is they resorted to questioning Jesus. That was also illegal in Jewish law. They couldn't question or make the accused compelled to answer anything, especially if they had no witnesses. So all of that was done under the cover of darkness, which is a, we'll talk about that in a minute. But their accusers never met the requirements of the law. Therefore, they had no basis for a charge. So they went ahead and started talking to Christ to get him to say something that they could use to convict him. After the trial was over, the Sanhedrin had to take a full day, if it was a capital punishment trial, to deliberate. Well, they didn't do that. You know, they voted instantly. And in the middle of the night, they voted. So all of this was kind of a interesting thing. The other thing, the Sanhedrin was not a court that was set up to try people for the death penalty. They really were adjudicating Jewish law and that kind of stuff. And the Talmud and other writings said if they did a death sentence more than once or twice a year, then they weren't doing their job in policing the regular operation of the Jewish law. But that didn't matter to them, you know. At this point, they had in their mind what they were going to do, and they did it. It's abundantly clear that their hatred for Jesus and their quest for power and their desire to kill him totally overrode all of the things of the Jewish law that should have guided the way they operated. And of course, they did it under the cover of darkness because they knew the people were with Jesus, and if they'd done it in the daytime, it would have become known, and they would have had a problem. So they did it at night, hoping to get him convicted and sentenced before early morning, and everybody got out, which actually worked for them. So we understand that. We understand that there were people that were opposed to what they were doing, but as I mentioned in an earlier discussion, the Jews were deathly afraid of the Sanhedrin and the chief priests because they could be put out of the synagogue. And we talked about that's almost a death sentence for a Jew. They couldn't worship God anymore. They couldn't buy anything in the market. They couldn't have any business dealings. It's almost like they were banished even though they were left in place. They were shunned by everybody when they were excommunicated or when they were put out of the synagogue. And they were very fearful of that because their whole life was built around synagogue and worship and being in the temple of God and being close to God, and all of that would have been destroyed. So we understand the fear of that, and we understand two people in particular, we'll understand in a minute, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, the guy that visited Jesus by night earlier. Both of them had become what I would say closet followers of Jesus, but they did not go out in the open, and the reason they didn't was because they were afraid of the Sanhedrin. So we understand a lot of that. So the religious leaders had murder in their hearts, and they'd done this thing all night. But as we learned last week, they didn't have the power to kill anyone anymore. The Romans had taken that power away from them. Yet they could stone Stephen because it happened, you know, at the spur of the moment, and nobody seemed to hold them accountable for it. And they did other acts of atrocities against Christians that they weren't held accountable for. So the Romans apparently were willing to give them a pass on some things. But they were afraid of this one because of the strength of Jesus as a prophet, the love of him by the people in general, and the miracles he'd done and all the things he'd had. So they took him to Pilate, and Pilate was the governor, I guess, or procurator, however you want to look at it, of the area. He was not the king. The king was Herod up in Caesarea, but he was the governor of that province anyway. And they took him there, but interestingly enough, it says that they took him there and they wouldn't go in to Herod's house or into Pilate's house. Remember that from last week? And they wouldn't go in because of why? Remember?
Passover.
They didn't want to be ceremonially defiled to eat their Passover meal. So I guess it kind of shocks me I've heard a lot of commentators talk about this, and I'll give you one. It's kind of a loose interpretation, but it does make the point. They're not concerned about murder. They're not concerned about breaking the Jewish law. They're not concerned about any of that, but they're concerned enough to say grace before the meal they eat on Passover, and they don't want to be able to not share the Passover meal. And I guess, you know, it does. I mean, if the word hypocrite ever pops in your mind, this is a good time for it to do it, because these people were perfect hypocrites. You know, they did the form and function of the law that was visible, but the stuff that was behind the scenes and nobody saw, they did it in the dark. And they weren't concerned about law. They weren't concerned about God. They were concerned about their own power. And so we see that right now. The one other thing I want to mention that we saw last week and we'll see again this week is Pilate really didn't want to crucify Jesus. We see that all through here. And what does Pilate say every time he comes out? I find no fault in him. I find no guilt in him. I see no basis for any charge. So it does sort of lay up the opportunity to think about the unblemished Passover lamb who comes to the slaughter at the Passover time. And here's Jesus being adjudged by the Romans to be not guilty of a thing. And yet he's the one that's going to be the Passover lamb for all of us. So that's just, I want to start with that, and we're going to get now to the lesson. So let's look at John 19, and we'll start in verse 1. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. I'm going to stop and talk about that in a minute. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they slapped him in the face. Once more Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, "Look, I'm bringing him out to you again to let you know that I find no basis for a charge in him." Couple of things here. One is, before any crucifixion would take place, there was a procedure in Roman law called being flogged. And they had actual men who did this. And they were called lictors, L-I-C-T-O-R-S. I don't know what that means in Latin. It probably means those that, you know, give a lick, but lictors. And they had a stick that they used called a flagellum. I'll talk about that in a minute. But this was a halfway death. They essentially sentenced a person who was going to die by crucifixion to go out, be tied up, and be flogged to the point where they're barely alive. Their back's opened up. You can see their bones. You can see their organs. You can see their muscles. They're torn. They're ripped. And if you saw The Passion of the Christ, the movie, I know when we were watching that movie, Vicky had her coat. And she would sit there, and at that point in the movie, she'd pull the coat up. She didn't want to see it, you know. She'd pull the coat down, pull the coat up. We got a glimpse in that movie of what a flogging looked like. We got a glimpse of the tragedy of that. But I can tell you that the glimpse we got was a cinematic glimpse. It wasn't the real thing. The real thing was far worse than that. The real thing was far bloodier than that. The real thing was far stronger than that. And many people in Roman society died or bled to death before they ever got to the cross because they were beaten to death by these lictors, you know, in preparing. So Pilate does that. And then he brings Jesus back out, clothes him in a purple robe, has a crown of thorns put on his head to basically try to get the bloodlust of the Jews to relent. He brings them out and says, "Here, I've had him, you know, here is the man," or "behold the man," he says. "I find no basis for a charge for him." But their quest for death, their thirst for blood wasn't quenched in that. They were committed for sure. Verse 5 says, "When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and purple robe, Pilate said to them, 'Here is the man,'" or "behold the man." And "behold," you know, we've talked about that before. "Behold" carries the idea of don't just look at, but actually look at with penetrating gaze and see what is happening. Look into his heart and your heart as you look at him. "Behold the man." But verse 6, "As soon as the chief priests and the officials saw him, they shouted," what? Crucify. Crucify. Pilate, of course, knew this was a sham trial. He knew it all along. He says to them, well, you take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis of a charge against him. I mean, this is the fourth or fifth time that he said this already. And you see another hypocrisy thing as we get a little further along, and I don't forget, I'll point it out to you. The Jewish leaders insisted, we have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God. Well, if you look at that law is not really that clear. What it says is if you blaspheme God, if you claim equality with God, and of course that presumes the idea that that's not true. It presumes that it's a false claim. You know, of course, in Christ's name, it wasn't a false claim. But they said, we have a law, and according to that, he must die. But as I remember before, if the Jews were to put him to death, it had to be by stoning. And the people who made the accusations had to throw the first stones. Well, they had no accusation, they had no accusers. They couldn't perform this death, even though they did it against Stephen. They couldn't perform it because in the public they'd be held up by the Romans, and the Romans would have had to do something about it because it had been stuck in their face. And so they couldn't do it. They had to depend on Rome for it. But when Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid. I want to talk about that for a minute. Pilate didn't want to execute Jesus at all. He knew it was a sham. But he didn't really understand either. And if you look at the other Gospels, you will find that his wife, Claudia, had a dream about not stoning Jesus because he was a righteous man, and she had implored him not to stone him, not to do anything because he was a righteous man. This was a trumped-up charge. No pun intended. And then so it was a charge made against him, but Pilate was in a box, and you're going to see the box as we move along. He was more afraid because now this took on bigger tones of just killing an innocent man. It was now something about God, and he was afraid of God. He didn't believe in God, but he had been around the Jews long enough and had watched the miracles enough to know that something was going on with this man, something important. So he brings Jesus back in, if you can picture the drama, and says, where do you come from? He asked Jesus. But Jesus gave him no answer. Verse 10, do you refuse to speak to me? Pilate said. Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you? Well, I guess the question is, if you're Jesus, what do you do? If you're Jesus or I'm Jesus, I have a different idea. But because he's Jesus and he's the Son of God, this is the cup given him by the Lord, by God. This is not a cup he's going to pass at this point. This die is cast. The prophecies have been made. The history is going to play out just the way it's been written. So he's not going to walk away. So Pilate's offer to free him is an offer that he's not going to take up. You know, because it's not his goal to come and be freed. His goal is to come and die a martyr's death, you know, for you and I. But Jesus finally answers him and he says, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. You know, Pilate's got to be pretty nervous now. He's thinking, okay, this is in God's hands. It's not in my hands, but yet I've got power to do something. And Jesus adds, therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin. I always wonder, who is the one? You know, is it Judas? Is it the Jews in general? Is it Caiaphas and Annas? Is it the high priest? And you can probably make a little case for all of those, but I think his real point here is the high priest. The high priests are the instigators. They're the ones that have set up and fomented this whole thing against him. They're the ones that are the ringleaders of what's going to happen. But he doesn't say they're the only ones that have sinned. He says they have committed a greater sin. In other words, Judas sinned. All of the Jews sinned. The Sanhedrin sinned. But the greater sin, in my opinion, is on the chief priest and the priests of the court, because They're the ones that should understand the law. They're the ones that are charged by God to be fair and be in the Word and do the things God has called them to do. And they were clearly not doing that. So verse 12 says, from then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free. Now, he's been doing this all along. But the Jewish leaders kept shouting, if you let this man go, you're no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. Okay, a little background here. If you don't understand Pilate, you need to understand a couple things about him. Pilate was no friend of Caesar. He'd been in a lot of trouble with the Jews. He'd done things he shouldn't have done. They'd turned him in before. He'd been punished by Caesar and by the other parts of the Roman Empire. He did not want to be called up again for violating Jewish law and not adhering to some of the things that they had brought forward. Because they had set the rules up of how this was going to operate, the Romans had. And for him to violate the rules, he had to be confident in himself, confident in his position, and he was not. So Pilate didn't want any problems. And he took the threat of the Jews very seriously to turn him into Caesar. Verse 13. When Pilate heard this, when he heard the charge that they were going to turn him in, he brought Jesus out and sat down at the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha, or Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of Passover. It was about noon. Okay, so he comes out to the judgment seat, if you will, outside of his area, and he sits down there. And I want to just position a couple of things for you. So Passover is going to be, they're going to have the Sabbath day, and Passover dinner is going to be held this night. They're preparing for Passover here. And the day before is the day they have the Lord's Supper. This is the night of the Lord's Supper. And of course, these 2 days are the same in Jewish law. So the night of prep, the night of the trial and everything happens here. And so it comes daylight and it's the day of preparation, but it's also the day that Jesus is tried and put on the cross, okay? Because the Sabbath is coming. It actually comes at noon or at dusk here. So we see the trial. Now, one of the things I want to mention to you, we talked earlier when we talked in John about which days of the week these are. And I'll just recount that for 1 second. Tradition says the Sabbath was a Saturday because that was the traditional Sabbath. But there's one little thing in here where it talks about the high Sabbath. And if you go back and read, we understand that there were two Sabbaths this week. So whether this was, whether it began Friday night or Thursday night, is your call. But that does make a difference as to whether Jesus is crucified on Friday morning, let's say, or Thursday, which really sets these days apart. It doesn't mean anything in the sense of how we celebrate and what we celebrate, because we still celebrate the events that took place in that day. The actual time they happen is less important, but you need to be aware that there are Christians who believe both sides of that story. And so whichever you believe, I'm okay with. But just understand that there is a little fly in the ointment for the 3 days and three nights in the grave, if you believe the traditional view. So we covered that. I don't want to spend time on it now, but I'll do it. If anybody wants to ask me about it, I'll do it later. So he sat down on his decision seat, the Day of Atonement, Gabbatha, and it was about noon, it says. So we're getting towards the middle of the day. And he says to them, here is your king. Here is your king. They shouted, take him away, crucify him. He says, shall I crucify your king? Pilate says. And what do they say? What do the chief priests say? We have no king but Caesar. Now, I want you, again, to come back to this. If you study the Old Testament, the Jews were punished ad nauseum through the prophets, through the judges, for having other gods, other kings before God. And here they are openly admitting that their God is Caesar. They have no other God but Caesar. So you talk about blasphemy. You talk about being disloyal. You talk about the first commandment, that shall have no other gods before me. There's many things you could talk about here, but these Jews, these chief priests, were guilty of blasphemy. They were guilty of having another god, putting Caesar in front of their god. Caesar claimed to be king. You remember that. So it's not the people, it's the chief priests. And John makes a point of that, which tells you the corrupt nature of this whole setup. And we talked about that before when we talked about Annas and Caiaphas and the, you know, son-in-laws and sons and the chief priests and chief priesthood being handed down for 30 years and keeping the same power structure. So Pilate's at the end of his rope here, and he comes to verse 16, and it says, "Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified." Pilate's done. He's talked to him. He's pleaded with him. He's asked him. He said they're not guilty five or six times, and they keep coming back. He's kind of at the point where he's doing what they're asked, and he can't be blamed by Rome for doing what they've asked because he tried to make it clear. What's not in John, but I think is significant, is in one of the other Gospels, it talks about a little thing he does where he washes his hands. You remember that? Washes his hands. That was not a Roman custom. That was a Jewish custom. A Roman didn't consider that at all. You know, if they had, what do you call that stuff? Purell? They probably didn't use it before a meal. You know, but the Jews, I mean, they washed their hands because they were afraid of, they wanted to be ceremonially prepared. So the Jews washed their hands. Pilate washes his hands and he wrings them out and he does what? You remember? He basically says, I've washed my hands of this. I am not guilty. It's your problem, not mine. Now, he can't do that in God's economy, but in his mind, he washed his hands of it, and it was their problem. And the Jews were fine with that. They wanted him dead. They weren't concerned about God punishing them. They wanted him dead. But believe me, they didn't miss that. They did not miss that sign from Pilate. You know, he put them on notice and basically said to them, "This is yours, not mine. You can say it's mine, but it's not mine. We Romans find no guilt. But because you have pressed, we're going to do this crucifixion." And so John makes pretty short work of some of the things to come, and we'll add a few things to them. So the second part of that verse, "So the soldiers took charge of Jesus." Now I want to say, once that happened, this was a fait accompli. It was going to happen. The soldiers they'd gotten an order from their commander, and they were going to make this happen. So they did what they always did. You know, they got the person out. He'd already been flogged. They got the cross out. And it says they took charge of him. "Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha." Now I want to stop there for a second. Two things that I want to say here. And, you know, we have the picture in almost every photo we see of Jesus with the cross over his shoulder, and both members of the cross and the long one hanging down, him dragging it. You know, we have the picture in our mind from David Wilkerson many years ago with his small cross and wheels on the bottom carrying it across America. There is some debate over whether that was the way it was done. And the reason there's debate is because in the Roman history books, what they talked about was the vertical part of the cross was embedded in the place. And the accused bore the cross member. And he was tied up, but it itself weighed over 100 pounds, so it was heavy. And because they were so weak after being flogged, they carried that. And all I'll say to that is, in the scheme of what happens, it doesn't matter. Don't get caught up in the trappings of the way it's been portrayed by Italian painters. You know, what happened was Jesus carried his own burden. He carried his own cross to his place of sacrifice. So for us, you know, he carried our sins just like the Passover lamb was supposed to carry the sins of the people. Whether he had a full-blown two-member cross or a one cross really doesn't matter. And you've seen pictures of a cross like the St. Andrew's cross, which is an X, and a lot of different things. And all I'll say is, it's interesting, it's nice to read, But it really, it's like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. It doesn't matter. However many want to. However Jesus carried this, the point is, he carried his own cross to the place of crucifixion. Now, it's a little interesting how they would get it up there and all the things about that, but there's a lot of issues with mechanically how they would do that anyway. And you remember from the Passion of the Christ, they loaded it up and you saw it slide down in the thing and go ka-thunk. You know, pretty dramatic. That could have happened. I don't know. Pretty dramatic anyway. But so he carried his own cross. And it says, there they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side, and Jesus in the middle. A lot of this there's a lot of powerful lessons in here. I'll kind of explain them as we go. But Jesus is put between two criminals. We always hear two thieves on the cross, and Jesus is in between. There's, you know, many a funny joke that people tell about, you know, somebody being between two thieves. You know, the pastors tell that joke and whatever. But the crucifixion is no joke. The crucifixion is a solemn, serious event. And so they bring him out to be crucified. And however they get him on there is for us to just think about, but we don't really know. Now, much myth has built up over this. And if some of you have been to Jerusalem, right? Almost all of us, if you go to Jerusalem, will walk the Via Dolorosa. You'll walk the path of the way of the cross. And every station of the cross has a little tiny church that you can go in and pray. But understand, that is tradition. That's not gospel. That is tradition. Now, it's early tradition from 300 or 400 AD, but it's not gospel. We can't say this is where Jesus dropped the cross. This is where somebody gave him a drink of water. We can't know that. But it does let you focus on the events that we know took place along the Via Dolorosa. But don't get hung up on the drama and all of the Catholic theology on that, because that's pretty much part of their dogma as to how that happened. And so it's taken a deep role in our minds because we've heard it our whole lives. So there's a lot of things that happen here. So Jesus is put on the cross. Oh, one other thing. Any of you ever sung the song "The Old Rugged Cross"? And how does it start?
On a hill.
On a hill far away. There's really no evidence that this was on a hill, by the way. And the reason I say that is the Roman crucifixions were always by the side of the road. And they did it so that every passerby got to see Roman justice up close and personal, so that they didn't misunderstand what would happen to them if they broke the Roman law. Now, whether it's a little hill or not, I don't know. But we picture this as some scene 800 feet off the road up on the hill. Don't think of it that way. Think of it as close. And everybody who walked by read the sign that was posted. Everybody who walked by saw what was happening. So that's just another little bit of mythology that we bring in. And even if you go today to Jerusalem, they have two locations for the cross. One of them is the traditional location, which is just outside one of the gates. But it's also not on a hill. It's on a road coming into the city. The other one is what they call the Garden Tomb. Well, I'll talk about that. Well, I'll talk about it now. Garden Tomb is not the traditional site, but it does fit better biblically than the traditional site. Now, I don't know which is which. I don't know that either one of them are true. We may not know and may not be able to ever know where Christ was crucified. But if you go into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you know, they have the marble tablet where they laid Jesus. All I can say is it didn't happen. None of that happened. None of it happened. They don't have any idea. This was all 300 or 400 AD when all this was built. But it's a focal point for worship, and you see people worshiping, and you see the lanterns, and you see all that, and it does focus people's attention, you know. And they have the hole where the cross was dropped. Now, they don't know where that was. So, you know, I guess all I'm saying is, if you go to Israel, be sure to separate tradition from archaeology, because archaeology gives you plenty to look at. Tradition gives you plenty to think about. But don't get hung up on the look and the place and all of that, because it's really what was set up by Constantine and his mother Helena in 300 or 350 AD. you know, when the Roman Empire was Christianized. So don't get too hung up on it. But crucifixion was painful to watch. It was painful for the person being crucified. It was also painful for those that had to observe it. And we saw that, at least a glimpse of that in the Passion of the Christ. Verse 29, Pilate had prepared and fastened to the cross a notice. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Pilate had a pretty interesting sense of humor, I think, because he knew this was a false charge. And he knew that Jesus, if Jesus was God's son and had talked to him about his kingdom not being here, but a kingdom later, not of this area, but later, he knew that Jesus was a king, but not an earthly king. So he puts this sign up, basically, I think, I don't know his motives, but to tweak the Jews. Because he puts the sign up, and he does it in three languages. He does it in Greek, Aramaic, and he does it in Latin. And so everybody who comes by can read it. You know, not a secret. Many of the Jews read the sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city. We do know that. And the sign was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. The chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, saying, don't write the King of the Jews, but write that he claimed to be King of the Jews. You know, that gives them their blasphemy charge written out. And Pilate says to him, what all kings and leaders say, I've written what I've written. You know, it's there, you know, live with it. So I've written what I've written. Now we progress down here, and of course there's plenty of other things if you read the other Gospels to look at. When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes, divided them into four shares, one for each, and with the undergarment remaining, this garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. Let's not tear it, they said to one another. Let's decide by lot who will get it. So they divided up the other stuff, and they took this one piece that was a fine piece of cloth that was had never been torn or anything like that. It was in one piece. There's a lot of discussions about that. But they cast lots. In other words, they gambled. They, you know, threw dice or something to pick what it was. And let's decide by lot. And then the next verse in 24, this happened that the scripture might be fulfilled. That said, this is Psalm 22:18, by the way. They divided my clothes among them, and they cast lots for my garment. So this is what the soldiers did. And I'll just make a point here. I'll reemphasize a point I made. Jesus would not pass this cup, because there are prophecies all through the Old Testament, and some that he's made in the New Testament about what's going to happen. And they are all going to be fulfilled. Not spiritually, but literally. So they're all being fulfilled one at a time. The casting lots is being fulfilled. You know, all of the things about his birth, his life, his death are all being fulfilled. And so near the cross stood his mother's sister, we know that to be Salome, Mary, wife of Clopas or Cleopas, and Mary Magdalene. Now, if you read the other Gospels, you kind of get a little, not a different flavor, but you get a, they call the other Mary, as they call her a different name. So I think what they are is you got Mary, the mother of Jesus, we know that, and then and her sister Salome. Then you've got Mary, who's the mother of James and Joseph, or Joseph, and then you've got Mary Magdalene. Those are the three Marys and Salome who are there to watch. And we also know that John is there. John the Apostle is there. I find it interesting, and I'll amplify this, Christ had brothers, half-brothers, and half-sisters. None of them were there. He had 11 disciples. Only one was there. Peter wasn't there. Andrew wasn't there. None of the rest of them were there. Why? I think they were afraid. They had retreated. They were hiding. They just wanted this to be over with, and then they'd sort of sneak out of town or do whatever. So John is there. And then we come to a really wonderful verse, verse 26 and 27. So Jesus is on this cross. You know he's in miserable pain. His feet have been nailed. His hands have been nailed. He's you know, in a crouching position, and the only way he can survive is to stretch long ways and get air in his lungs, because collapsing down, it shuts off the air in your lungs, and they died of asphyxiation most of the time. So he's there, he's in pain, and yet he looks out and he sees his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby. John never names himself, but we know he's the disciple that Jesus loved. And saw here is, again, that word that says he didn't just glance out there and think she might be there. He saw her. He looked at her. He beheld her. And the disciple whom he loved standing nearby. And he says to her, "Woman, here is your son." I'll make a point. I've made this before. The term woman here is not, we think of it as a cold term because of our culture, but in that term, it really wasn't. It was more like lady or ma'am or something. But he didn't say mother, but he called her a more formal name, you know, which would be lady or you know, woman. "Here is your son." And I'm sure he can't point, but he knows that John is there. And to the disciple, he said, "Here is your mother." Don't you wonder why none of his brothers and sisters were there? Don't you wonder why, as the eldest son, the responsibility to care for the mother wasn't passed to the next eldest son in the family? Joseph is not mentioned. He's probably been dead for a while. So she's got her family. She's got Jesus. And she's got John. And what Jesus does as the male heir to the family line, he passes the responsibility to John the Apostle, not to his brother. And we know two things. We don't know everything about all of his family, but we do know that James, the author of the book of James, was his half-brother. We also know Jude, the author of the book of Jude, was his half-brother. But neither one of them had come to faith yet, and neither one of them was given this responsibility by the Lord. So he gave it to John. Any of you ever been to Ephesus? Some of you have probably been to Ephesus. Okay. So if you remember going to Ephesus, it's in Turkey. We went on a tour called The Footsteps of Paul. A grueling tour, by the way. If you ever want to do it, you know, get your walking shoes and start walking about a month before you go. But they take you to Ephesus, which is in Turkey. And you see these ruins. There's no church there now. There's just ruins. Some of them have been restored a little bit. But there is a place called the House of Mary there. And what you know is, if you study, John spent many years as a pastor in Ephesus. After Paul had left, he went to become the pastor, sort of to become the resident saint there, if you will, and preached many, many years there. And Mary went to live with him there and lived in that house. Now, in some of the religions that deify Mary, they changed this idea to say that Jesus gave John to Mary, and Mary was the keeper. She, like he was her son now, and he kept her, she kept him from harm. That's totally not reality biblically. John was the one who made those decisions, and Mary willingly went with him, because she knew she wasn't going to get that support. She'd been, you know, vocal for her son, and her other children had tried to have him put away because they thought he was crazy. And so she knew where her loyalties were, and she went with John. And that's kind of an interesting thing. And of course, if you've been on that tour, you probably also went to the island of Patmos, and you went up to see the cave where John wrote the Revelation and the Revelation of Christ. And it's powerful to see that and see where he was and see where he wrote and, you know, the little island and all. We didn't get to spend too much time there, but that was really a monumental thing for us. So we move on to the death of Jesus, verse 28. "Later, knowing that everything had now been finished and so Scripture would be fulfilled as it had to be, Jesus said, 'I am thirsty.' A jar of wine vinegar was there, so they soaked a sponge in it, put the sponge on a stalk of the hyssop plant, and lifted it to Jesus' lips." So understand, he's going to drink bitter drink, and we understand that was a prophecy. We also understand that they didn't want to get up close to him. Not that they couldn't reach him. They didn't want to get up close to him for fear of getting his blood and everything else all over him. So they used a stick to hold it up to give him a drink of this liquid. And he took the drink, and then he said, "It is finished." With that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. But really, there are other last words, and I want to. I don't have much time. I know I've got what 5 minutes. I'll get these in. Last words are important. The last words of dying individuals. If you ever do a study of last words, you'll find that there are remarkable last words that people say. Some that are defiant, some that are thankful, some that see the Lord, some that see a light, some that hold their hand up and say something. There are many words that people say that are last words. Some plead, some beg, and some sing. You know, there's all sorts of things people do. Last words are important. So if I want to just recap some of these last words. In the other gospel, it says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Jesus is acting as the high priest for the people there. He's saying, he's taking their sin to the Lord and saying, they don't know what they're doing. I mean, but the reality is it was God's plan, but they were the perfect foils for it. They did exactly what he knew they would do. But forgive them, for they know not what they do. One of the criminals hurls abuse at him. "If you're really king, take yourself down and take us with you." And the other one says, you know, "Are you blaspheming God?" You know, and he tells Jesus, "Remember me when you get to your kingdom." Remember that? So what does Jesus say next? Jesus says, this is Luke 24:43, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." Do you know paradise is not a Hebrew word? It's not a Latin word. It's not an Aramaic word. It's not a Greek word. It's a Persian word. And the Persian word means the garden of the gods. So Jesus is saying here, I mean, picture the Garden of Eden. He's basically saying, today you'll be with me in my garden, in God's garden, in my place of peace, my place of rest. It's kind of interesting. We don't hear much about that paradise, and there's a lot of people who want to argue about what paradise is and isn't, but it means the garden of the gods in Farsi or whatever Persian spoke at that time. So, and back to John. Woman, here is your son, and to John, here is your mother. We talked about that. Matthew 27, at the end, Jesus cries out in a loud voice, and I can't pronounce the Hebrew well, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" So understand here, Jesus as the Passover lamb had the full weight of the world, all the sin of the world on him, your sin, my sin, everybody's sin, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And because that sin blotted him away from God, he felt abandoned. He felt forsaken. And the word he uses here for forsaken is the same word is used other places in the Bible about abandonment. It's the same word. So he feels that. It was the first time and the last time in his life he'd ever feel separated from God, which is comforting to us. John 28, "I am thirsty." John 30, "It is finished." Luke 23, 46, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." We could talk for hours about this, and if you've listened to sermons, you've probably heard many sermons on these subjects. But understand at the very last moment, Jesus' words are, "Lord, I'm in your hands. I commit my, this is your plan. I'm doing your will. I'm in your hands. I commit my spirit to you." And so we understand that what John says, you know, that his spirit and his spirit went to the Lord. And so we look at that and we say, you know, it's amazing how all the details fit together. But of course, with God, the details do all fit together. We may not understand them all, but they're all in perfect harmony with one another. Verse 31, "It was now the day of preparation," which is this day back here, "and the next day was to be a special Sabbath." Remember my conversation about being two Sabbaths? There are two Sabbaths every so many years. And this was one of those years. Because the Jewish leaders did not want the bodies left on the crosses during the Sabbath, they asked Pilate to have the legs broken and the bodies taken down. Soldiers therefore came and broke the legs of the first man who had been crucified with Jesus, and then those of the other. But when they came to Jesus and found he was already dead, they did not break his legs. Instead, one of the soldiers pierced Jesus' side with a spear, bringing a sudden flow of blood and water. Then John adds a little personal touch here. The man who saw it, and I believe that's him, he's the witness, has given testimony. His testimony is true. He knows what he tells. He tells the truth. He testifies so that you may also believe. These things happened so that the scripture would be fulfilled. In Exodus 12:46, Numbers 9:12, and Psalm 34:20, it talks about not a single bone will be broken. And another scripture says, Zechariah 12:10, they will look on the one they have pierced. So picture him on the cross. They've pierced it. There's a lot you could make out of the blood and water too, and I probably won't have time to do that today. But so he's now dead on the cross. Verse 39, later Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly because he feared the Jewish leaders. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. He was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who earlier had visited Jesus at night. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds. We talked before about how expensive this stuff was. This is a huge amount of money for Nicodemus, but he was wealthy. Taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it with spices and strips of linen. This was in accordance with Jewish customs. So I want to make a point here. They didn't come forward before Jesus died. Now that he's dead, they do come forward. And by touching his body, you know what it does? It disqualifies them from taking Passover because they've touched a dead body. You can't touch a dead anything. You remember the story of, I guess it was Samson, you know, reached into a dead lion and got honey, legally defiled, but, you know, it's a whole other story. But now they come forward. Now they risk the wrath of the Jews. Now they... risk getting kicked out. And I guess the question I ask is, were they disciples? Were they casual followers? Were they believers? I don't know the answer to that. I think there's some church history that gives us some clues. Who knows? One of them gave up his tomb in the garden. The other one gave up the money for the aloe. And they did it. They wrapped him themselves. So I guess what do we take away? If they had come forward, would it have made any difference? Well, it wouldn't have to Jesus, because Jesus was on the path he was on. But would it have to them? Would they have stood in the gap? Would they have made their opposition known? Would they have taken a stand where they should have? I think that would have been different. Now, I don't know what would have happened because of that, but they didn't. So our takeaway kind of is, When you need to take a stand, you need to do it. And sometimes you'll pay a price for it, and that's the price God has ordained for you to do that work, to be stand in the gap for him. And you never know when you're going to be called home or the person you want to talk to is going to be called home. You may miss an opportunity that you wouldn't miss, that you would miss otherwise. And, you know, we need to talk to our friends. We need to talk to our children, our grandchildren. We need to make sure they understand that opportunities are brought by God. And we need to take advantage of them when they come. And then verse 41, and we finish. At the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb, in which no one had ever been laid. Because it was the Jewish day of preparation, since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. So it was late in the day. It was before dusk, but late in the day. You've been to the garden tomb. A lot of you have been there. There's about three or four things in that tomb that are really strong indicators to me that it was either that tomb or one like it. First of all, there's a place that looks like Golgotha right next door. Now, there happens to be a bus station that was built by the Palestinians, so you can see the eyes and the nose, but the mouth has been kind of replaced with asphalt. And then to the left of it is the garden tomb, and you see a tomb cut out the way it's described in the other Gospels. If you remember, you go into the tomb, and the body is to the right. Most tombs were built where you go into the tomb and the body is in the back. And so they would prepare the body, and they'd lift it up on the shelf, and they would come out, and they would seal the door. This one, the tomb, the thing is on the right, and that's the way the Gospels talk about when Peter and John go and they look in and they see where the cloth is. You understand the way that's is built. Plus, there's a track for the stone to be rolled away. Plus, there's another little thing called a soul window, which, if you're familiar with Jewish history, the soul window on a Jewish tomb was a little gap that was above the door and up high. Not big enough for animals to get in, but big enough for the soul to escape. You know, when the soul left the body, the soul would exit out in their belief through the soul window. We know that doesn't matter, just like we know Jesus didn't have to roll away the stone before he came out. You know, he could walk out. But you know, that was their belief. So that authenticates it as an early Jewish group. I don't know whether it's the right one. And there's a garden there. Beautiful garden. Many of you have taken communion there. We have done that too. So no one knows what the right place is. But as we go and as we see these places, they really should remind us strongly about who we are, who God is, what our responsibilities are, what he gave up for us, and we should come to a stronger faith. You could walk in front of me. I would not be disturbed. Choir is leaving. I appreciate you staying this long. So that's something we all should do. And I need to wrap now so we can get out and get over to church. But so let me say a prayer real quick. Lord, we're thankful so much for the words you've given us, both in the Gospel of John and the other Gospels, that teach us and show us how all of the life and death of Jesus was a fulfillment of prophecy. What he said, what he did, how he lived, how he died, all the ways it happened give us proof and strength that you're a God that makes promises who turn into history. It may be written in advance, but it's history that we can read and see. Lord, we know you're not finished with us yet, and as we continue to live our lives, we know that there's many things in front of us that you've laid out that will happen. We just pray, Lord, that we're able to read those and understand them as best we can. Lord, I pray for Pastor Jeff as he preaches today. The sermon is your sermon given to him with the power and the presence to deliver it in a fully whole and hard way for all of us. Lord, I pray it all in Christ's name. Thank you all. Amen.
You're a blessing to us, Jeff.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.